Chapter 11. Nearly 2,000 iron warriors stood in unmoving ranks before Kroger, and the idea that they were his to command staggered him. Since leaving Hydra Cordatus, a moment that had given him an unaccountable sense of relief, he had wrestled with the idea that he was a warsmith of the 4th Legion. Orders were his to give, and lives his to command. Until now, his only power of life and death had been that which rested on the edge of his chain blade, or in the magazine of his bolter. Now, his very words would decide whether men would live or die. Part of him relished that power, but the bulk of him resisted the inevitable distance that would put between him and the bloody edge of war. His weapons were as much a part of him as his hands and heart. Only in a swirling, bloody melee could a warrior ever feel truly alive. Life was at its most distilled in the spaces between the blades and bullets. Behind the ranked-up warriors were squadrons of armoured vehicles, rhinos, land raiders, mastodons, and hybrid machines fashioned by the new machina from the wreckage of damaged vehicles and the strange machinery torn from the heart of the dismantled Cadmean Citadel. Since reaching the edge of the warp anomaly, the new machina had worked with feverish intensity in their sealed forges, crafting ever more lethal-looking machines, as if just being in the shadow of this mysterious region had somehow empowered their labours. Some of their creations were blatant in their purpose, little more than towering gun carriages or infantry crushers, but others were less obvious, festooned with caged machinery and dangerous-looking devices that seemed to serve no clear purpose. Kroger marched down the length of the ranked warriors, a vision of burnished iron with gold and jet chevroning. These warriors had brought countless worlds to ruin, toppled the fortresses of the mightiest empires, both human and alien, but who, among the Imperium of Man, knew any of their names? At Kroger's insistence, none of his warriors wore their battle helms, each man's stoic face staring straight ahead in iron unity. For the most part, they had dark hair, close cropped to the skull, but here and there he saw a warrior with the long scalp locks common amongst those from Locos, the tattooed walls of the Delconians, the blood-tinted hair of his own folk from the Etheirac Mountains, and the forked beards favoured by the Vedric Tyrpex. He would know the men who fought for him. He would learn their names and tell them that he knew their deeds, for how else would they fight and die for him? He looked closely at their faces as he passed. Hard features, worn smooth by genetics, enhancement, and war-won knowledge. The Iron Warriors knew the craft of death like few other legions, and they had made uncounted sacrifices in service of the ideals of the Imperium. These men were mighty. They had fought to bring the galaxy to compliance. Their reward was to be cast aside in favour of those legions with greater roles of honour, legions that had prospered on the broken backs of the Iron Warriors. Heroes of the Ultramarines, the Blood Angels, and the Imperial Fists were lauded and immortalised in art and verse, but where were the parades for the Iron Warriors? Where was their glory? The answer was quickly forthcoming. In ashes on Olympia. Blown to the wind from a billion worldwide pyres. Those who should have clamoured for tales of its crusading sons were all dead. The Legion had burned them all, and the despair of that day was etched into their skin, like ashes smeared on the cheeks of grieving widows and faithless sons. But Kroger felt no guilt for what they had done on Olympia. What did it matter that it had been the world that the Lord of Iron had called home? His world or another? It was irrelevant. Any other planet would have been burned and razed to the ground, and no one would have cared. Only the name gave it significance, and names were just noise. Like grief, guilt was rust that ate the iron in a warrior's soul, and Perturabo had spoken to the entire Legion in the ashen reins of their homeworld, telling them that guilt had no place in his Legion. Guilt was for lesser men who looked to the past for validation. The Iron Warriors would never allow the crippling taint of guilt into their ranks, for only the future would give them validation. Kroger's thoughts were interrupted as he saw a familiar face in the front rank of his Grand Battalion. He knew he should walk on, that there was no point in drawing attention to a wound in the pride of the warriors he now commanded, but the spiteful part of him couldn't resist the chance to rub a little salt in one particular wound. He paused before Harker, pleased to see his former warsmith's stature now much reduced. "Harker," he said, only just stopping himself from calling him warsmith.
"Kroger," said Harker.
"That's Warsmith Kroger," he said.
Harker nodded and swallowed the bile that must surely be rising in his throat.
"You have found a place in the Grand Battalion?"
"Yes, Warsmith," replied Harker. "Battle brother, 55th Storm Squad."
Kroger knew it. Mediocre earth grubbers and breech fodder.
"You will fit right in there," said Kroger. "Sergeant Gaster is competent."
"Competent was never enough for me, Warsmith," said Harker, and the bitterness in his voice was so rich that Kroger had to force himself not to laugh in the man's face.
"No, and look where that attitude got you."
"Permission to speak freely, Warsmith?" asked Harker.
Kroger hesitated, but nodded eventually.
"Speak, but do not waste my time."
"It is a heavy burden being a warsmith. I know this all too well. There are 1,000 responsibilities that rest on your shoulders alone, and broad as they are, Warsmith Kroger, you do not have the experience to carry them all yet. I could help you."
This time he did laugh in Harker's face.
"You would help me. I replaced you after the Primarch stripped you of your rank. I can almost feel your blade between my shoulders now."
Harker shook his head and said,
"No, Warsmith."
"Why would I ever trust you, Harker?"
"Because what else have I to lose? The Lord of Iron will never grant me rank as a warsmith again, so what advantage would I gain in betraying you?"
"Personal satisfaction?"
"I won't deny the truth of that," said Harker, "but I can help you make this Grand Battalion something legendary. You have the Primarch's ear. You have fire and force. Ally that to my experience, and you would be Perturabo's most trusted triarch by the time Horus sits upon the throne of terror."
"You only aid me to gain standing and prestige," sneered Kroger.
Harker shrugged.
"There is no shame in that."
"I suppose not," agreed Kroger. "But I would take a snake to my bed were I to trust you."
"I did not say you should trust me," said Harker. "Just that you should listen to me."
"I'll think about it," said Kroger.
Bear girders columned the bridge of the Iron Blood, and bolted gantries stacked above one another ran the length of it, each filled with augmented servitors to man the more mundane elements of the ship's operation. A handful of iron warriors manned the stations requiring post-human input, though only a few were known to Perturabo. He stood with his arms folded across his chest, staring impassively at the billowing flares, strange tides and curling bursts of ejected warp matter displayed on the viewscreen. The combined fleets of the Iron Warriors and Emperor's Children held station at the very edge of the star maelstrom, its fire-bright core seething like a star in its death throes, as the rippling haze of its storm-racked corona expanded to swallow everything around it. Umber light from the storm's heart bathed his features, making them ruddy and hale. The warp-borne illumination played over Perturabo, dancing in his cold eyes like firelight. For once in his life, Perturabo looked at the star maelstrom and knew that others could see it too. They did not see it quite as he saw it, but they could at least acknowledge its existence. He saw beyond its dark light to the engulfed worlds within, phantom images that ghosted in and out of perception, and fleeting moments of solidity in a realm where such things were anathema. He saw planets where all reason and Euclidean certainty had been abandoned, where the physical laws that underpinned the galaxy were playthings of lunatic forces beyond mortal comprehension. Worlds of fire. Worlds that were somehow crafted into geometric shapes. Worlds wreathed in unending lightning storms. Islands of ephemera that were vomited into existence and destroyed an instant later to sink back into the roiling chaos from which they had been birthed. Madness held sway in the nightmarish confluences of this storm, a rain of inconstancy that would break even the hardiest sanity. Yet, amid the endless cycle of creation and destruction, one of the half-glimpsed worlds retained a sickening solidity. A bleak world of lifeless rock and crooked spires, where an impenetrable sun, like the pupil of an impossible eye, held sway in a sky of unchanging emptiness. Perturabo blinked, and the dead world and its black sun sank back into the malignant hues of the star maelstrom. For as long as he could remember, since coming to awareness on that rain-slick cliff, he had felt the gaze of the star maelstrom upon him. It had always looked down upon him, judging him, measuring his worth and spying on his every moment. A life lived beneath its cold scrutiny had made him brooding and loath to offer his trust, ever watchful and aware of its baleful glare. It had always been with him, and always would be. And now he was to venture into its depths, following the guidance of an alien seer. What would he find in there? And more to the point, what might find him? Somehow he had always known he would one day enter the star maelstrom. Its call had been gentle, but insistent, a reeling in that had been as invisible as it had been impossible to ignore. Part of him resisted the idea of summons. He could give the order to turn his legion around and take its hundreds of ships to where he could more readily contribute to Horus Lupercal's war effort, but every time the thought surfaced in his mind, it was obliterated like a timber palisade before a melter ram. Perturabo had lived his life under the gaze of the star maelstrom, yet this was the first time his ships had ventured near it. Why should that be so? He had been a Primarch in the Emperor's armies. Hundreds of star-faring vessels were his to command, and no one would have questioned him had he chosen to lead his expeditionary forces here. The answer was obvious. Until now, he had no need to venture within. Fulgrim may have given him superficial cause with his tall tales of imprisoned war deities and weapons of the apocalypse, but Perturabo knew that wasn't the real reason. He had come because now was the time to see what lay within the Star Maelstrom. Star Maelstrom? How long had he known it by that description, without ever learning its true name? Perturabo called up the astrogation charts for this region of space stored in the Ironblood's data engines. The viewscreen shimmered as it was overlaid with a neon-bright grid, curving arcs and flickering key labels for those few stellar objects in this region worthy of a name. At the heart of the screen, a vertical black label bisected the fiery orange heart of the star maelstrom like the eye of a great cat. Imposed upon the bar was a name. Cygnus X-1. Perturabo knew the star maelstrom was not the first spatial anomaly to bear that name, and whichever lowly scribe had ascribed it again was a fool. Something this powerful and terrible deserved a name to strike fear into the hearts of all who saw it, a name that would resonate down the millennia until the end of time, when the stars went out and the only light in the universe was the nightmare glow of the star maelstrom's ever-devouring borders. Pachirabo's fingers danced over the slate from which the charts had been brought forth, and his thin lips curled in an approximation of a smile, as the name in the vertical black bar changed. It would change throughout the fleets, spreading to any data engine that called up maps of the galactic northwest.
"Yes," he said, "a name to lodge in the hearts of all who hear it."
The Iron Blood's engines flared at Perturabo's command, taking it into the Star Maelstrom. No, not the Star Maelstrom. The Eye of Terror. They called it the Dodecatheon, after the 12 tyrants of Olympia. And the Masons' Order of the Fourth Legion had met aboard Iron Warrior's starships before Perturabo had even been reunited with his gene sons. There was nothing secret in its formation or gatherings, nothing hidden at its core, and no secrets worthy of keeping in its activities. It was a true meeting place of builders and warriors, where new structural designs were unveiled, past battles refought, and new theorems of war given voice. Every warrior of the Legion was welcome, but in practice only those of rank had the opportunity to attend any of the lodge meetings. Kroger had known of it, as had every Iron Warrior, but he had never found the time to seek out a meeting. On the approach to the anomaly in which lay the weapons of the Angel Exterminatus, Barban Falk and Forex had arrived at his arming chamber as he was replacing the blunted teeth of his chain blade.
"You have bond serfs to do that," said Forex.
"I prefer to do it myself," said Kroger,
sitting cross-legged in a steel-dust habit of Hessian and male links over his body glove. 100 or more razor teeth were spread on an oiled cloth before him, like trophies taken from the jawbone of some mechanized shark. Each one was polished and fresh, oiled and ready to rend.
"You have better things to do with your time," said Falk, as though irritated by a fellow triarch performing such a manual task. "Such as?"
"Coming with us," said Forex, reaching to lift the sword from Kroger's grasp. Kroger snatched the weapon away before Forex could touch it.
"Don't touch my blade," said Kroger, fingers curling around its hilt. "Where are we going?"
"To the Dodecatheon," said Forex. "It's time you were known there." Kroger eased his grip on his sword and laid it on a sword rack against the wall, amid a host of blades, bludgeons, and firearms.
"The Mason's Order?"
Forex nodded, and they led him into the gleaming, oil-scented hallways of the Iron Blood, through corridors he travelled regularly, and chambers he had never known. They crossed vaulted processionals of ranked artillery pieces, with hundreds of heavy armoured vehicles suspended on massive chains from the strengthened roof trusses. They climbed great spiral stairs that wound around thunderous columns of magma-hot power and super-hardened magazines packed tightly with shell casings, entrenching gear, and millions of rounds of volatile ammunition. More than any other legion, the interiors of the Iron Warriors' vessels were given over to supply and logistics, for their way of war depended on a steady supply of high-explosive warheads. Though it was easy to become lost while travelling through the guts of a starship, Kroger knew they were heading toward the Iron Blood's frontal sections, the high-walled chambers of hot iron and sweating pipework through which they passed became ever more cramped as more and more space was given over to the prow weapon systems, the vast tubes of the forward torpedo arrays, and power relays serving the heavy gun batteries mounted to either side of the carved ram of its bow.
"You've really never been to a gathering of the Dodecatheon?" said Falk.
"Never," said Kroger.
"Why not?"
Kroger shrugged.
"Always seemed like there were more important things to do with my time than talking about war. I prefer to be ready for fighting."
"You are a triarch," said Forex. "Talking about war is part of being ready for it now."
The curving ramp they were descending opened out into a long, lancet-vaulted, triumphal way, along which numerous groups of iron warriors were gathered in tight knots,
Some pored over sheaves of architectural plans, while others clustered around hololithic displays, projecting schematics of wall details, projected bombardment patterns and fire schedules. Perhaps 100 or so warriors had assembled, some in armour, some in their mesh and mail robes.
"It looks very informal," said Kroger.
"Don't let appearances fool you," said Forex. "This is as much of a viper's den as ever you might imagine. Alliances are made and broken here, pacts and oaths sworn and forgotten before the night's end. It's all very useful."
"Doesn't sound useful at all,"
Forex grinned.
"On the contrary, to see who favours whom and where plots are formed is knowledge that will stand you in good stead when it comes to deciding upon your order of battle. Pitch any three warsmiths into battle alongside each other, and it's always good to have some healthy rivalry between them. Judging the right level of rivalry can spur each warsmith to greater heights of endeavour, just as getting it wrong can cause your army to fight itself as much as the enemy."
"I see," said Kroger, though the idea of engineering rivalry between warsmiths seemed needlessly antagonistic.
"Do other legions have orders like this?"
"Other legions have since established similar orders, but the Dodecatheon was in place long before Lorgar's errand boy thought to supplant it with a lodge of his own making."
"Aye, we soon sent that worm packing," laughed Falk. "We have our order, and we don't need any other."
Heads began turning as word of the Trident's arrival spread through the assembled warriors. Though rank and title were left at the door in the Dodecatheon, some were too important to be entirely left behind. Nods of respect followed the three warriors as they made their way through the press of bodies. Kroger saw faces he recognised, faces he had never seen before, and faces that didn't look like they belonged in the Fourth Legion. One such face belonged to the scarred Emperor's children swordsman, who had accompanied Fulgrim into the Cavia Ferrum, the same warrior who had put him on his back. Lucius, Fulgrim had called him, and with his twin sword sheaths empty at his waist. Kroger's hand flashed to his own scabbard before he remembered that he too was unarmed. Lucius grinned as he read the anger in him and sketched a casual salute.
"Why is that slippery bastard here?" he asked. "A gesture of cooperation between legions," said Falk, practically spitting the answer. "We invite one of Fulgrim's warriors to our order, we send one of ours to theirs."
"A spy?" "An emissary," said Forex. "An ambassador."
"Who did we send to them?"
Forex shrugged.
"The Stone Rot and one of Barossus's men. I don't know his name."
Lucius moved from sight, and Kroger saw the silver-white hair of warsmith Toramino as he conversed with a shaven-headed warrior with his back to Kroger. The two warriors slipped into the side cloisters of the chamber, but not before the warrior turned his head, and Kroger recognised Harker. He had warily accepted Harker's offer of help, all the while knowing the man would eventually betray him for position. But it still surprised Kroger how quickly his new equerry had run to Toramino to boast of his influence with the newest triarch. Perhaps there was something to the notion of attending such meetings to gauge the ebb and flow of treachery and infamy, after all.
"The Trident," said a grating voice with all the warmth of a glacier. "You do not often grace us together. The coming fight must be serious indeed."
An iron warrior in full armour emerged from the crowds and came towards them. He wore the burnished iron of the Legion, his golden jet polished to a brilliant finish, but the bulk of his armour was the cold ivory of an apothecary. One gauntlet was enlarged with the tools of the healer and custodian of the dead, the other bearing a jade sceptre in the shape of an elongated lightning bolt. One end was topped by a sapphire sphere filled with vapour, the other by a jade sphere of rippling liquid contained within an invisible energy field.
"Iron within, honourable," said Forex,
inclining his head in a gesture of respect. Falk also gave a nod of respect.
"Honourable Solarka," he said. "Iron within." "Iron without," said the apothecary with a curt bow.
Kroger did not know this Solarker, but instinctively disliked him. His features were roguish and handsome, dark-haired with pale blue eyes that might once have been attractive in a mortal face. His smile was that of a bad iterator, sincere and empathetic, but utterly lacking in real conviction.
"So, this is Warsmith Kroger," said Solarker, holding out his free hand.
Kroger shook the hand, wrist to wrist, feeling a strength in the man he hadn't expected.
"Greetings, Solarker," said Kroger. "My title here is Honourable," said Solarker. "It is the one rank that endures among the equals who come here, but as you are new to the order, I take no offence."
Kroger nodded stiffly at the bland rebuke.
"Be at ease in our company," continued Solarker, leading them deeper into the chamber. "There is much in which to take part."
"Like what?" asked Kroger.
"I'll show you."
Long chains hanging from the distant ceiling bore flaming brands that created a low ceiling of dark smoke, making the space feel claustrophobic. The hubbub of voices was pleasantly soothing, but there was an undercurrent of fierce pride that coloured every mention of casualties, breaches, escalades and lines of advance. Solarker led them past a table heaped with rubble that Kroger at first mistook for debris come loose from the walls, until he saw the grey-coloured blocks being used to represent companies of warriors and artillery.
"We refight battles from the past," said Solarker, "ours and those of our brothers, to learn from their mistakes and improve our tactical protocols."
Through the broad shoulders of the legionaries gathered around the table, Kroger saw a lovingly fashioned representation of a great tower surrounded by more numbered blocks of units, this time coloured black.
"Here, the warsmiths of the 34th and 88th Grand Battalions are refighting the Siege of Doolan," said Solarker with a grin, "though I hope they will not come to blows like their historical counterparts. There is the Iron Citadel of the Aurishan Technocracy, where we have found that by committing Angron much earlier to the fight, the butcher's bill would have been much reduced, for the sons of Horus, at any rate."
He gestured to a third table.
"And there we have a recent acquisition, the Battle at the Perfect Fortress, a defeat suffered by our brothers of the Third Legion, despite aid from the Lord of Iron in the planning of its architecture."
Kroger stopped to admire the representation of the perfect fortress laid out on the great stone-rimmed hololith. Civil structures and fortifications were one and the same, with each portion of architecture a bastion of defence, a strong point and habitation in equal measure. While the walls and buildings were built with what looked like aesthetic considerations uppermost in the war mason's mind, the roads and infrastructure were clearly the work of a more pragmatic individual.
"The population are shields," said Kroger, scanning the city for weakness. "Or civil defence forces, depending on your point of view," said Solarker. "They're meat shields," said Kroger, "but whoever designed it that way is an idiot."
A ghost of movement, and Kroger felt perfumed breath at his ear. "The Phoenician himself designed it," said Lucius, with a too intimate hand brushing Kroger's neck as he slid around him. "Are you saying my Primarch is an idiot?" Kroger threw off Lucius's hand and fought the urge to rip the smug bastard's head off. He felt the solid presence of Barban Falk at one shoulder and Forex at the other, taking a measure of pride that they stood with him. To attack Lucius would be a mistake, for numerous reasons, and the swordsman knew it. Kroger swallowed his anger and nodded towards the perfect fortress.
"It's a flawed strategy to rely on the compassion of your enemies," he said. "This city depends on the attackers being afraid to target the populace. That wouldn't be a consideration if I was leading the attack."
"Imperial forces don't think like you do," said Lucius, and Kroger watched the play of scar tissue on the swordsman's face. Many of his wounds were poorly sealed, or deliberately kept from healing properly. The effect must have been painful.
"They will," said Kroger. sooner than you think. And anyway, this perfect fortress fell, didn't it? Wasn't so perfect after all, eh?
It fell, yes, but not through any failing of the design, said Lucius.
Then why did it fall? Demanded Falk.
Because we had tired of it, and letting Korax and his monsters have it was more agreeable, said Lucius.
My legion are warriors, not jailers. We are not suited to be custodians of conquered worlds. We leave that to other, less vigorous legions.
Kroger laughed at the pettiness of the insult and pushed past Lucius towards a vast topographical arena that was part physical representation, part holographic construction. It occupied the entire end of the chamber, a rendering of the mightiest fortress Kroger had ever seen. It wasn't a defence raised by mortal hands. It was the greatest landmass of a world shaped by a mighty being to become the strongest, most revered and most implacable fastness in the galaxy. A masterwork of immense proportions, its complexity and functional beauty took Kroger's breath away. Though he had never once set eyes on this place, he knew it exactly for what it was.
"The Imperial Palace," he said.
"Ah, yes," said Solaka. "A permanent fixture of the Dodecatheon."
A score of warriors surrounded the table, each one commanding some aspect of its defence or undoing. By their orders were holographic representations of grand armies sent into battle, numerically tagged divisions of tens of thousands, advancing and retreating like blood-red surge tides as they laid siege to the palace. Hecklers shouted advice to the combatants, yelling to indicate sudden assaults from hidden sally ports. Portions of rampart left weakly defended, breaches to be exploited, and gateways left broken by relentless artillery barrages. Yet for all the millions of legion warriors and army auxiliaries laying siege to the Imperial Palace, Kroger already saw it was hopeless. The defenders were too entrenched, the walls too high, the defences too coordinated, and the cunning of their construction too ingenious to overcome. Few of the attacking armies had a hope of getting over the walls, and most never would. Suggestions bombarded the attacking generals, ranging from the obvious, "More guns, more assaults," to the ridiculous, "Fight harder." Every suggestion that was acted upon was met and countered with ease, the warriors taking the role of defenders, parrying and repulsing each attack with the bare minimum of effort. Watching their moves and counter-moves, Kroger recognised a pattern in their efforts that was entirely different from those in which he had trained. The warsmiths were defending the palace with the tactics of another legion.
"They're using Imperial Fist doctrines," said Kroger.
"Of course," said Solaka, appearing at his side. "Dawn and his Labourer Legion are the ones fortifying the palace, so it makes sense to play by his rules."
"That's not particularly inspiring," he said, as yet another attack was swept from the Kathmandu precincts and an assault of the Dwalagiri elevation was repulsed with terrifying losses. Casualties were in the hundreds of thousands.
"I agree," said Solaka. "But our armies outnumber the defenders 10-1. Eventually they will get in."
Kroger shook his head.
"Perhaps, but whoever is left standing in the palace will be master of the largest ruin on Terra," he said.
"You think you could do better?" said a voice behind him.
All conversation ceased, as the Lord of Iron emerged from the shadows, resplendent in his full battle armour and with Forge Breaker harnessed across his back. The cybernetic interfaces across his scalp shimmered in the torchlight, and his melancholic features were hooded and dark. Fulgrim's ermine cloak hung from his shoulders, the fastening skull gleaming, and the inset gemstone streaked with numerous golden lines.
"My lord," said Forex, "we did not know you were here."
"Clearly," said Perturabo,
as the iron circle emerged from the shadows behind him. Forex was amazed that the Primarch's shield-bearers had been able to infiltrate the prow space without anyone hearing the heavy footfalls of their approach. The bulky armoured battle robots flanked the Primarch as he made a slow circuit of the palace table. He shook his head as though disappointed at his warrior's lack of ambition and vision. His cold blue eyes scanned the frozen positions of the armies laying siege to the palace, and his lips pressed into a thin line at what he saw. Kroger watched the Primarch's displeasure and remembered why he had been brought into the Trident.
"Yes, I think I could do better," he said.
Perturabo looked up and said,
"You think you could take what your fellow warsmiths have so spectacularly failed to capture?"
"I do," said Kroger.
"Then you are either a fool or extremely gifted."
"Perhaps a little of both."
"We'll see," said Perturabo. "Restore the battle simulation to baseline. Begin again, and this time Warsmith Kroger will assume the mantle of assault command. All other parameters to be the same. Begin."
Perturabo stepped back from the holographically enhanced model as the dead returned to life and the fictive armies withdrew. Kroger shook his head and pointed a mailed fist at him.
"No," he said. "Not all parameters will be the same."
"What would you change, my bold Triarch?" asked Perturabo,
leaning on the edge of the table and letting the green shimmer from the table's hard light projectors illuminate his face with a spectral glow.
"I don't want to fight warriors following another Primarch's stratagems."
"Then who would you fight?"
"I want to fight you," said Kroger. "I want to see what happens when Perturabo defends the Emperor's palace."
The Apothecarian was silent, and Cadmus Tyro was reluctant to break that silence with his words, but who else could he talk to? In truth, the chamber had long since ceased to be a place of healing. Now it was a tomb, wreathed in the chill of the grave, and used only to inter a brave man whose wounds should have seen him dead thrice over. He sat beside Ulric Branthon's casket, with his hand resting on the frosted glass surface. Haptic sensors registered the cold and measured the contained energies of the stasis field within, but there was no sensation beyond what the augmetics were telling him. His bionic replacement was more sensitive, more receptive and stronger than the limb that had been cut from him so long ago, but he found he now missed the reassuringly organic feel of his hands. Strange that a memory of flesh should come to him here, where flesh was by far the most redundant material present. His own body was over 60% mechanized, his legs, one arm, his lungs and a significant portion of his cardiovascular system. A phage cell infection received from a leukotoxic biopathogen while clearing out the Gallianic cluster had seen to that. Not that he had minded at the time, of course. Only the truly favoured were able to leave the weaknesses of the body behind so swiftly and so completely. Only Vermanus Cybus matched Tyro in chimeric biomodifications. But Cybus had long been viewed as pathological in his reverence for the machine and loathing for flesh. In truth, Cybus was a warrior not even his battle brothers could be around for any length of time, for his adherence to the doctrines of augmetic superiority had already spread through the Legion even before the death of Ferus Manus and his warning against such beliefs to the Iron Fraternity. Garuda felt Tyro's disquiet and rubbed its metallic head against the rasped skin of his neck as if to comfort him. Where the steel of Tyro's augmetic arm joined with his shoulder was a flexing mass of integrated tissue that webbed in a fine mesh with the base of his neck. It itched abominably, but the analgesics that normally soothe the irritation of the skin had all been requisitioned for the operation of Branthon's casket.
"Easy. The captain will be restored to us," said Tyro, aware he was addressing his words to a bird that could not answer him.
He corrected himself, a bird that chose not to answer him. Garuda and Ulric Branthon were boon companions, and it had often seemed as though they had spoken via some invisible communion.
"Ah, Ulrich, you've got me talking to this damn machine of yours," he said, tapping his fingers on the glass in a rhythmic tattoo. "It's been as loyal as any of us. I'll give it that."
No answer was forthcoming from his captain, nor had he expected one. Apothecary Tarsa had suggested that it might help Brantham if he were to hear familiar voices around him, providing a link between the frozen world he now occupied and the world of warmth above. They had taken it in turns, since Istvan, to come to the apothecarian to speak to their former captain and give voice to the trivialities of the day, the operations they had planned, and the fears they had for the coming war. Tyro suspected the salamander's suggestion was more for the living than the living dead. Since breaching the outer regions of the Great Warp Storm, Veruci Vora had been as good as his word, guiding the Sisyphean between its squalls and immaterial thunderheads with a deft and subtle hand. Breaching so dangerous a storm would normally have made for a juddering, nightmare-filled voyage, but the Eldar paths below had kept them from the worst side effects of so dangerous a journey. Even the Geller fields were unnecessary, though Tyro had kept them raised anyway. Vora assured him they were making good time, but it was impossible to know for sure. Every Auspex reading was garbled nonsense that registered only impossible spikes of tortured physical reality, and every chronometer aboard the ship had either ceased functioning or skittered randomly forwards and back in time. Truly, this was a realm of impossibility, and they were flying straight into the heart of it.
"I'll be honest, Ulrich, I don't know what I'm doing," said Tyro, shaking his head. "They look to me to have the answers, but I don't have any to give them. You were always the captain who saw the bigger picture. I was just a line warrior with a title. I don't know if you have any connection to the ship now, but we're about as far from anywhere sane as I could ever imagine. If you can believe it, we're taking an Eldar at his word and letting him guide the Sisyphean into the largest warp rift I've ever known, chasing down some wild story of ancient gods and doomsday weapons. You'd put a bolt through the Eldar's head as soon as look at him, and we'd be back doing something useful."
Tyro paused as Garuda hopped from his shoulders to land on the edge of the casket. The bird preened as it walked the length of the icy container, and Tyro wondered if it knew why its former master wasn't coming out.
"It's all gone to hell, Ulrich. We're fighting the bastards, I swear. We're all fighting them, and we're doing some good, too, and we're not alone anymore. We've made contact with 25 other fighting cells. We're cutting enemy supply lines, denying them easy passage. We've broken their communications and killed thousands of traitors. Our kill ratio is higher than ever, but I just don't know if it's enough. I don't know what the Primarch would do, and that scares me."
The admission shocked Cadmus Tyro, for he had long since imagined himself purged of that crippling emotion. Fear was what lesser mortals endured. Decades of training, psycho-conditioning, and iron discipline had made his psyche impervious to the mind-killer. Tyro had faced monstrous alien beings, hordes of greenskins intent on carving him up with motorized cleavers and shrieking ethereal horrors that pushed through the barrier between warp space and reality. He had faced all these, and more, without fear, yet the yawning uncertainty of their future had all but unmanned him.
"Should we go back to Terra? Regroup with the rest of the legions? Or should we stay out here, because we're actually fighting, actually killing the enemy? We're the shattered legions, and we're hurting them. But are we hurting them enough to matter? I don't know, and I don't know how to fight without certainty. You and the Primarch gave us that certainty. But where do we go from here?"
His iron fingers curled into a fist.
"Azenoth's blood! We need you, Ulrich," said Tyro, opening his fingers and slamming his palm down onto the glass.
The stasis field shimmered and buzzed as the casket registered the impact. A warning chime sounded, and a red light winked to life on the thermostatic controls. Garuda took to the air with an angry blurt of binary that sent a spike of pain lancing into his skull. Tyro sat back, suddenly nervous. Had he disrupted some vital system? He didn't know. Should he send for Atesh Tasa? The red light winked out, and Tyro exhaled a sigh of relief. The very idea of something changing within a stasis field was patently ludicrous.
"You see, emotion. We're all at breaking point, Orak," said Tyro, getting up and pacing the length and breadth of the chamber. "Ever since Ferus, since Istvan, we've been fraying at the edges, unravelling, and I don't know how to stop it. We're losing what made us great, Orak. The iron will at the heart of us. It's, I don't know, it's rusting or coming apart."
Cadmus Tyro stopped at the end of Branthan's casket and leaned forwards, resting his elbows on the beveled edges, letting the frustration of months of isolated warfare in the north bleed out of him in a juddering sigh.
"This isn't the kind of war I was made for," he said. "I'll fight it, and we'll bloody the foe. But can we win it? I'm not sure."
Only the hum of machinery and the skitter of claws on the casket's lid disturbed the silence. Tyro stared at the blurred outline of the man he had followed into battle 100 times and more, a lifeless effigy of life instead of life itself. A corpse frozen in time, just waiting for some distant archaeotechnician to dig him from an exposed glacier.
"You know, I think these are the longest conversations we've ever had," he said. "If you weren't in that casket, I don't think you'd have listened to half of what I'm saying. You'd have slammed me into that wall and told me to get a grip of myself. You'd have said that I was a fool to let the weakness of flesh rule my thinking. And you'd be right to do it."
Garuda tapped its silver beak against the glass, and Tyro straightened with a soft chuckle that utterly belied his grim mood.
"You're right," said Tyro. "Let's go. The captain needs his rest."
He hammered his fist against the battle-scored metal of his plastron and held out his arm for the mechanized eagle to hop on. The bird backed away from him and tapped its beak on the glass again. He beckoned to the eagle, but the bird steadfastly refused to come to him. Its moods, if mechanized confections could be said to have moods, were often inexplicable, but this was obstinate even for it.
"Come here," he said. "Now."
The bird didn't move. Tyro reached for it, but Garuda pecked at him, and its beak crackled with electrical discharge as it made contact, cutting the iron of Tyro's gauntlet like an energized blade. He snatched his hand back, but before he could give voice to an angry curse, he saw what had drawn the bird's attention. It wasn't at first apparent what he was seeing, because his mind refused to accept it. But the more he looked, the more it became impossible to deny. Branthan lay as he always had, cold and unmoving, with the heart of iron wrapped around his body like a squatting mechanical parasite. His limbs were still wrecked and broken, his chest ruined by the 4 mass-reactive craters punched through his torso. No, not 4. Tyro saw only 3 bolter wounds.